restless. The idea that Leon might one day actually abandon him was suddenly so unbearable that it choked him, and he was quite unable to speak. He felt his heart pound in his great barrel chest. Tears started under his closed eyelids and began running down his cheeks. Instead of gently wiping away the tears, Leon began pinching Sir Ralph's face, as if to gather the tears up like tiny fallen leaves or spilt crumbs in his hand. This pinching felt cruel, and the cruelty excited Leon. But instead of moving as he usually did towards some sexual expression of his anger, he left the Rajah's bed and began upon a terrible diatribe of how, whenever white men came to the Rajah's house, they scorned him and belittled him. He, Leon, the man upon whom everything depended. He said he heard the word savage, unspoken, but directed by thought alone against him and all his race. And the Rajah, you whose very name is savage, had never defended him. With the Jesus boy, he had communed in secret hammocks. And as for Septimus Scaife, why had this uncouth man not been told that Leon was to be treated with courtesy and respect? Was all this surely not proof that Sir Ralph did not truly love him, did not truly see him as an equal, but only used him as a slave to satisfy his carnal appetites? Let the Rajah think upon this. For the time was coming when Leon would have made his own fortune, when he would lie down in his bed, not with any white Rajah, but on a mattress stuffed with silver dollars. And then he would buy a prau and sail away. He would become a prince in his own right. Malays could be princes and rajahs. He would go to the Celebes or to the Aru Islands and fight primitive tribes and soon enough come to rule over others. He would cease his perversions with men, except when he felt a violent need for them. He would marry a beautiful woman and make her his Rani and father children. He would carry a jeweled dagger at his waist and wear rings on his fingers and a golden anklet on his leg. He would found a dynasty in his own name, while Sir Ralph would die without an heir, die all alone, unconsoled by his treasures, as the forest bore down on his ridiculously named Savage Road and infested it with tangled vines and the roots of vigorous trees and the nests of snakes. With the true essence of Borneo. In fact, against which the Rajah had waged a constant war but never understood. This outburst of Leon's was so wounding that Sir Ralph felt himself descend into a feeling of helpless shock. He opened his eyes, and through tears which now stung like nettles on his lashes, regarded his lover, who was pacing back and forth in front of the Rajah's bedroom window, where a coral sunset provided a blazing background to the scene. He couldn't speak, but his long and terrible thought was, all my happiness is going to be lost to a dream, and the dream will fail. Chapter 37, Cat's Cradle. The next day, the Rajah walked to the river and saw Scaife making preparations for what he called an explosion experiment, placing his paper tubes of gunpowder just shy of the water's edge in the strange architecture of the mangrove roots. Wire fuses to set in train the explosion made tangled journeys in and out of the tubes. I will start with a little powder, said Scaife, to gauge the resistance of the trees. Then, if I've calculated rightly, I will put all in train for a very mighty blast. Once the debris is cleared away, you have clean land on which you can begin to build your canning sheds. Sir Ralph watched the shaking hand of the engineer placing the pods of powder and inserting the fuses. Beyond him, he saw what Leon had described as the bloody chaos of the river, choked by felled trees, which the current was not strong enough to carry away, and it felt to him that this place was a terrible landscape of what was in his heart. He wanted to tell Scaife to cease his work, to go back to Singapore. But now, after Leon's diatribe against him, he feared to bring about more rage. He'd spent the night trying to work out exactly why Leon had said such hurtful things, trying to understand what it was like to be Leon. And he had seen, perhaps for the first time, that although he lived in comfort and luxury, Leon longed for something else. He longed to rule. By advising the Raja to build his road, he had supposedly been showing the Englishman how to establish mastery over his lands. Yet that mastery was fragile. Nature kept on and on reclaiming the road, as Leon had surely known that it would. Perhaps he laughed a bitter laugh whenever the rains began. He had probably come to understand that no foreigner, whether Dutch or English, could hold sway for long in Borneo, because there was too much about the island that they didn't understand and would never understand. They relied on clever Malays like Leon to tell them what to do. So why should he, Leon, remain in a position of servitude when he was the one who possessed the knowledge needed by the ruler? All that kept him there was his lack of money. Here, then, lay the reason for his enthusiasm for the cannery. He knew that Sir Ralph would wish to have little to do with such a complicated, messy enterprise, but that there might be hard currency to be made from it. And he, Leon, would put himself in charge of the accounting. If all went to plan, and cans of filleted Subaru and well-prepared soft-shell turtle could be exported to China and beyond, then Leon's dreams of riches might be realized. And then he would leave. He would go in search of his own small empire to rule. Dismay at the logic of these thoughts gripped the Raja's heart once again as he stood watching the engineer fumbling with his fuses. He saw how easy it would be for Scaife to be blown apart, and sudden compassion for the man overcame him. He thought, we all risk being defeated by some small weakness in us that we can't control. And then that is the end of us. He didn't want to remain at the river. He had the notion that to lose himself in the forest for a while, to remind himself that nature could be sublime as well as unkind, would bring him some respite from sadness and worry. To return to his house, he would have walked due north, but leaving the Sedong behind until he could no longer hear its running over the rapids, he turned east and proceeded at a slow and careful pace. He soon came upon a family of gibbons and stopped to wonder at their furtive little faces looking down upon the white man. They scattered as he moved forwards, and this disappointed him, as if he'd hoped to have some kind of conversation with the animals and was hurt by their fear of him. And this foolish wish revealed to him how alone he felt himself to be. Not far from where he was walking, he knew there was a small Dayak settlement, and he wondered if he might come across it and stop to rest there and drink a cup of arak and admire the pumpkins the Dayaks grew in strange abundance. The chief delight of this tribe had been to play a complicated form of cat's cradle, or what they termed scratch cradle, with the Raja. And it always made him marvel at the different patterns they could make with the string, far superior to any he had ever learned in his 50 years of life. The Raja began listening out for the sounds of human habitation, but all he could hear was the great orchestra of the forest, and he held his arms up in a gesture of surrender to its music, which, when his own death came, would continue without pause. Then he walked on, managing to find pathways through the trees into small glades, where the bush had been cut and where burning sunlight fell. In one of these glades, he noticed that the air was tainted by a foul scent, and he expected to find a carnivorous pitcher plant growing there. Though these insect-eating plants always spoke to his curiosity, he also knew that they would emit a horrible stench, their bulbous stems being full of half-digested flies. The Raja looked around and around. What his eye eventually lighted upon was not a pitcher plant, but a shallow mound, covered with a few stones and branches of foliage. Sir Ralph knew that dead animals were seldom buried in the forest. They were eaten by men or wild hogs or vultures. Approaching the mound, he fought off the sickness that rose in his throat from the vitiated air and gave all his attention to measuring the grave in his mind. It didn't take him long to conclude that this was the fragile tomb of a man. By the time the Raja reached the Dayak settlement, he felt weak from heat and thirst, and from a new and terrible thought which had entered his mind, that he had stumbled quite by chance upon the last resting place of Edmund Ross. He was relieved to have found the Dyaks. Though he had once fought them, as enemies of the Sultan of Brunei, this was not widely known along the Sudan. Indeed, some on the lands he now owned chose to regard him as a deity come among them, and this both moved and amused him. They did not merely bow to him, but liked to touch him, trying to ascertain if his skin, his hair, his fingernails, and his eyes were made of flesh and blood, or rather of some other immortal substance they would never be able to name. This touching of him sometimes felt like childish tickling and would make the Raja giggle, and this pleased the Dyaks greatly, and they would set up an answering clamor of laughter all around the white man, loud enough to silence the tree frogs and the bad-tempered toucans. Once he had been told by a Dyak woman that when he died, he would certainly be reborn just as before, wearing his white garb, with his grey hair tied back in a black ribbon, and his feet shod in old army boots. And this superstition seemed to take flight and travel around the settlements, so that now when the Dyaks encountered the Raja, they tried to overcome their awe by gestures of ordinariness, offering him mangoes to eat or shaking his hand, pumping it up and down, in the way of a white man's greeting. When they saw him now, staggering a little in the heat, his forehead running with sweat, three Dyak men came out of the shade of their huts and led him inside, where they sat him down on a floor of fresh palm leaves and brought him water in a wooden bowl. The Raja thanked them. He inhaled the cooler air of the hut and the piquant smell of the men's bodies and felt himself soothed a little. He closed his eyes and had a sudden longing to surrender to sleep in this place, which was far away from Leon and his anger. But he suspected that he might offend the Dyaks by falling asleep the moment he'd crossed their threshold. So to distract himself and stay awake, he reached into the pocket of his robe and brought out a pile of tangled string.
"Cat's cradle?" he asked.
The men clapped their hands with delight. At the door now, two women stood looking in at the Raja prone on the palm floor and put their hands over their mouths, suppressing laughter. One of the Dyak men snatched the string away from Sir Ralph and in seconds had untangled it and fashioned it into the overlapping loops around his fingers needed to begin the game. He held these out to the Raja, who drank more water from the bowl, then began delicately picking at the string to make a first figuration. The Dyaks laughed. The cradle was then passed to another who contrived something far more complex with it. Sir Ralph stared at this, wondering where he might go with it, and the men watched him closely, enjoying his puzzlement. At last he decided to lift two of the loops down and outward, thinking to undo the last construction and begin again, but it wouldn't come apart. And once again he was struck by the Dyak's ingenuity in this simple game. He made a new move, but saw that it could easily be unraveled. The third Dyak beat his own thigh with pleasure as the strings were passed to him. Winning against the deity always seemed to give him vivid pleasure. When the game was over, Sir Ralph yielded to sleep. As soon as he woke up, he could see that the sun was beginning to set and that he would have to leave quickly if he were to find his way back to his house before dark. But he found that some rice had been put near him and a bowl of arak, and he knew that this hospitality couldn't be refused. So he yielded to the idea that he might spend the night with the Dyaks. This held only one terror for him, that the tribe would offer him one of their women. The three men who had welcomed him and with whom he'd played cat's cradle now sat near him, watching him very intently. Then an elderly woman came in, carrying a bulky parcel wrapped in banana leaves, which she set down before the Raja, and the men gestured for him to open it. The leaves slipped away easily, and Sir Ralph gaped at what he saw before him. Pair of worn boots he had last glimpsed hanging over the edge of a hammock in his garden. He took the boots and held them tenderly against his chest. He saw the Dyaks shaking their heads sadly.
"England man," said one of them. "Lost, you see, Raja. Vultures eat face. We put this lost man in the ground, branches above his cradle."
The Raja said nothing for a while. Then in a hoarse whisper asked,
Did you kill him?
No,
Sir Ralph, said the oldest of the Dyaks. We told you. This was a lost man. In Borneo, lost men die.
Chapter 38. No Nearer to Certainty. When Valentine Ross arrived at Henrietta Street, to be told by Sir William that Jane had taken the early train for London, a first feeling of disbelief turned swiftly to anger. He'd walked with passionate strides from Edgar's buildings, in joyous haste to see his fiancée, and to present her at last, in front of her father, a valuable emerald and diamond ring that had once belonged to his mother. He had spent part of the night polishing the ring in methylated spirits, and he saw it afresh as a thing of great beauty. But now, without any word or warning, its intended recipient had abandoned him.
Why? He cried out,
and then could not prevent himself from adding crossly, London? She did not have my permission to go to London. Sir William looked at him with a calm but accusing stare.
She did not need your permission, my dear Ross, he said. Her Aunt Emmeline had suffered a heart attack and is gravely ill. She sent for Jane. As you know, Emmeline and Jane are almost like mother and daughter. Jane could not hesitate.
Ross turned away and stared out at the street. The sun was shining on the soft colors of the stone and putting a bright glaze on the black painted railings. Though struck by the calm beauty of this scene, he felt that such beauty had no value, but was merely a meaningless arrangement of once pleasing but now pointless things, if Jane had indeed left the city. The ring seemed to burn in his pocket. In the weeks when he'd walked about in the euphoria of at last possessing his mercurial angel, he had felt himself to be the most fortunate man in England. Now she had suddenly left him again. He could not stop a black fury from descending on him.
Did Jane leave me no note? He asked. I would have thought this was a courtesy she might have considered.
Sir William, if not surprised by Ross's anger, then slightly surprised that he wasn't able to conceal or control it, laid a consoling hand on Ross's arm.
My sister's condition appears grave, he said quietly. Worry on this score took all else from Jane's mind except how she might get to London as quickly as possible. You will have to forgive her the lack of a note. She will return as soon as Emmeline recovers. I hope it will be soon. And if she does not recover? Why then both Jane and I will be in deep mourning. My sister is a remarkable woman. I understand this, of course, but are you saying that this mourning would mean the postponement of my wedding to Jane? And mine to Clorinda, said Sir William. Not necessarily, for life must go on. But I advise you, if you are to keep and hold my daughter's affection, you should understand the role that her aunt has played in her life and make all allowances for the love she feels for her.
Not liking Sir William's chiding tone, Ross merely repeated his hope that Emmeline Deane would make a quick recovery and strode quickly away to his surgery. Here he sat down in his comfortable leather swivel chair, took a handkerchief from his pocket and dabbed at his brow. He had 20 minutes before his first patient arrived. These 20 minutes appeared to him too slight a time in which to compose himself. His mind was so aflame with conflicted thoughts about Jane that he could only feel towards this hapless patient an animosity he knew to be entirely unreasonable. Throughout his career as a doctor, he had often had to master the skill of putting his own emotions aside in order to concentrate on the case in hand. But on this occasion, James' departure for London appeared to him so thoughtless, or even spiteful a thing, that he felt quite undone by it. He cursed her. He let himself wonder whether Jane had even used her aunt's indisposition as an excuse to go to London for some other reason. Although she had seemed to suffer some pain when he'd first made love to her, there had been no blood on the sheets, thus indicating to him that she was not a virgin. Was it possible, then, that she had taken a lover during her long stay at Tite Street and, despite her promise to marry Ross, would brazenly continue to visit him? Ross took the emerald ring from his pocket and threw it into a drawer of his desk. He wished at this moment to have Jane by his side, not to hold or to kiss her, but to hurt her. How, he asked himself, have I arrived at such a pass, where the only woman I can love, the one woman I cannot live without, who arouses me beyond all reason, treats me with such disdain? Am I just a toy to her, to be thrown down or cast aside whenever it suits her? He knew that his desire to hurt her was unworthy, yet he asked himself whether many husbands did not, in fact, keep their wives obedient to their needs and commands by imprinting bruises on their white flesh, an excellent and eternal flowering, the mark of the male. And he let himself believe there and then that when Jane returned to his bed, that he would treat her much more roughly than had been the case so far. At this moment, there was a ring on the doorbell, and Ross, assuming that this was the announced arrival of his patient, tried as hard as he could to put his thoughts about Jane from him entirely. But he did not entirely succeed. When a knock on his door came, he stood up and composed his features into the calm and benign alignment he'd perfected in all his years of doctoring. But it was not his patient who came in. It was Becky. Dropping her grudging little obeisance, she held out a crumpled small package towards him and said, "Letter, sir. Your servant brought it down from Edgar's buildings. He said it looked important." Ross took up the letter and saw that it was stained and torn and crisscrossed with the faded stamps of authority from postal offices in Singapore, Aden, and Southampton, and sealed with a blob of what looked like animal feces flecked with chaff. For a moment, his heart was lifted by the thought that here, at last, was a letter from Edmund, but he saw directly that it was not Edmund's writing on the paper. He dismissed Becky. He sat down at his desk, his mind now gone from Jane, and travelling towards the possibility that some catastrophe had befallen his brother. His hands shook as he broke the crusted seal. He peered at a few lines of almost illegible writing and read, "Dear Mr. Valentine Ross of 31 Edgar's Buildings, please hear our prayer. Your brother, Mr. Edmund, has fallen captured. He is prisoned by a Dyak tribe. This people take human heads. They ask me for silver and ransom. But I do not have what they ask. Send, please, money for release of Mr. Edmund. They ask 500 shillings. I am Malay chief in this region, and only I can speak to Dyaks. Please send to me, and I will bring this brother to be free. Send to me, Chief Leon at Savage House, Kuching, in Borneo." Ross read the letter several times. Each time, two conflicting thoughts asserted themselves almost simultaneously. The first was that what had been written here did indeed describe some terrible crime that threatened to be inflicted upon Edmund. The second was that a trick was being played upon him, upon Dr. Valentine Ross of 31 Edgar's Buildings, and that any silver paid in ransom would go straight into the pocket of Leon, the letter writer. These two interpretations kept sliding up and down in Ross's mind, as if on some complex moral vector where nothing remained fixed. Where was the truth? He saw that however long he stared at the paper, however long he examined the marks which crowded it and the dirty crumbs which had broken away from the seal, he would get no nearer to any certainty. Yet what he also knew was that the fate of his brother, in the recent delirious times strangely absent from his thoughts, must now be brought back into the forefront of his mind. Chapter 39. Anteroom. Emmeline Dean lay very still and looked up at what was above her. She saw a distant vaulted ceiling, as though she might have been in a concert hall or a church, but she had been reminded that she was in a hospital and that she had only one task to perform, and this was to rest. She wasn't a person who set great store by rest. It had always seemed to her that life was a gift, briefly given, and that those who sat and stared out of windows or who lay on daybeds, asking nothing of their bodies or their brains, but a passive surrender to inertia and vacancy, were despicable non-entities. She knew that her own life had been hard, and that there had been moments when she'd fallen into despair, but she also believed she kept a bargain with existence. She had embraced the world. She had kept striving for truth in her art. Now her heart had faltered. In her dreams, she imagined this heart, once so faithful to all her endeavors, coming apart in small but fatal rents, letting blood ooze out to clot around it, so that it was destined to struggle harder and harder to keep beating, and would soon give up the fight and stop. Sometimes in these dreams, Jocelyn Halton appeared and stood above her, looking down at the damage her heart was suffering, with his hand covering his mouth as if he feared he might vomit. Then he walked away. In every dream, this is what happened. Jocelyn never spoke a word, but only turned and walked out, closing the heavy door behind him. And Emmeline usually woke up at this point and found herself once more in the hospital, looking up at the high ceiling. She wondered if, in its dark magnificence, it was calling to her spirit. She knew that this call had to be resisted. She wasn't ready for death. Yet it seemed to her that the nurses who visited her bedside, who gave her no help and no instruction but to take doses of laudanum and lie still, were resigned to letting her go. And it was this terrible resignation that had led Emmeline to call out for Jane. Jane, she knew, would fight on her behalf. She would find the right words to rally her. But if she was indeed dying, then she could think of no companion she would rather have at her side than Jane. She saw the scene as if from afar. She lies and gazes, not up into the void, but into Jane's eyes, which are steady and kind. Jane holds her hand. His hand is already getting cold. Jane massages it gently, and Emmeline can feel what 1,000 other sufferers have felt, the healing touch of the Angel of the Baths. When Jane arrived in the hospital ward, Emmeline was sleeping. She saw that the bedsheet had been pulled right up to her aunt's chin, as if in preparation for its further unfolding to cover the dead face, and she did not like this at all. Gently, she pulled the sheet back a little and put her palm against Emmeline's cheek. She noticed that Emmeline's hair was tangled on the pillow and that it had not been washed, and she did not like this either. She wanted to take her aunt in her arms and carry her back to Tite Street, to the smell of turpentine, into the sunshine coming through the skylight, and let everything be returned to life and brightness and the perfume of a creative life. A hard chair had been set by the bedside, and Jane sat down on this, allowing her hand to rest lightly upon Emmeline's head, so that when she woke up, she would at once know that she was not alone. Only now did Jane begin to look around the ward. She saw that the shutters had been closed across all but one of the narrow windows, so that the inmates of the beds were consigned to a peculiar daytime twilight. The air in the room was stale, unmoving, as though this air was considered almost unnecessary and was a foul, rationed quota deemed just sufficient for the fragile lungs which breathed it. Jane peered through the semi-darkness, searching for a nurse, to whom she would have begged for a window to be opened, but she could see no one moving around the ward. And the female patients, each in her iron bed, appeared to be in a state of utter quietness, taut white sheets pinning them down, their bodies subservient to some fearful command not to move, as if rehearsing for the tomb. And then it occurred to Jane that this ward was the one where the dying were put. Now and again a nurse would pass through, administering the laudanum that kept them quiet and relatively free from pain, but mainly they had been abandoned. She suspected that no doctor came here. The doctors had relinquished all obligations towards these women, believing that nothing more could be done for them. Jane knew that they wouldn't blame themselves for this impotence. They would blame the women for passing beyond their collective store of medical knowledge. To walk around this ward would only have put them in a state of irritation. That Emmeline had been put here now filled Jane with a righteous anger. Her aunt didn't belong in this anteroom of death, and she saw it now that it was her task to get her out of here before she suffocated in the darkness and floated out of her life on a sea of opiates. She stood up and bent over Emmeline, shaking her gently by her shoulders and saying her name. Though she said it quietly, the beautiful word Emmeline seemed to echo up towards the vaulted ceiling and circle there like the cry of a lone seabird following a ship. And this cry brought a nurse scuttling from some nearby room, carrying the lower section of a wooden leg, complete with its cleverly jointed foot. She went straight to Emmeline's bed and pushed Jane aside, using the leg as a weapon. Jane cried out, and this cry seemed to wake a few patients from their slumber, and the room was suddenly filled with the noise of lamentation.
"Now hear what you've done," said the nurse. "Whoever you are, you must leave at once. This patient must be left to die in peace."
"No," said Jane. "No, I am not going to let her die. Her heart can recover."
"It will not," said the nurse, now gesturing with the leg towards Emmeline's breast. "She will be dead by tomorrow."
At these words, Jane pushed aside the terrible leg from her aunt's body and threw herself upon her and began begging her to wake up. She feared at any moment that she would be felled by the nurse, the wooden leg falling upon her neck like an axe. And in her constant awareness of how human behavior descended from one moment to the next into the farcical, saw how ridiculous this scene was becoming. And yet it felt right to her that she was fighting for Emmeline. Her brave aunt could no longer struggle. Jane would be her defender and take her away from this cathedral of death. The nurse didn't hit her. She retreated in her heavy shoes to wherever she had come from, but Jane knew that this was only to summon reinforcements and that she would probably be manhandled out of the ward and into the street. So it was with great urgency now that Jane begged Emmeline to come out of her drug-induced sleep and speak her name. But Emmeline's eyes remained closed. Her breathing was shallow, so shallow that it could almost not be heard. At the corner of her mouth, a tiny bubble of spittle bloomed and then burst. Jane now sat on the bed, pulling Emmeline into her arms and rocking her back and forth, just as she might have comforted a weeping child. But it was she who now wept. She wept for all the suffering Emmeline had endured, for her loneliness, for her lost beauty, for her golem, but most of all for the love her aunt had given to her, the love of a mother, which, if Emmeline was indeed surrendering to the death prescribed for her here, she was going to lose. A trio of people came, a nurse and two black-coated doctors. Jane laid Emmeline down very gently, smoothing her hair from her temples and placing a kiss on her forehead. The trio did not touch her, but only waited, so close to Jane that she could smell the fustian of the men's coats and the tobacco on their breath. She turned to them, seeing in all of them stares of implacable hostility, and told them quietly that she was Miss Emmelina Dean's niece and herself a nurse, and she would be able to care for her in her own house. She informed them that on the morrow she would come back in a hansom cab. She asked if her aunt could be woken early and made ready for the short journey from the hospital to Tite Street. "And thereafter," she added, "you will be released from all responsibility for her, and I will be the one who takes it on, for I do it gladly, and I know that is what Miss Dean would have wished." The nurse who relinquished the wooden leg said nothing, but looked towards the doctors, waiting for one of them to speak.
"As I understood it," said the elder of the two men with a sniff of irritation, "this woman is not expected to survive."
Chapter 40, The Treasure House. The hansom cab from Paddington Terminus had deposited Jane first in Tite Street, where Emmeline's maid Nancy had aired and warmed the room Jane had occupied during her long stay in London. And it was here that Jane had intended to return after she was cast out of the hospital in the early evening. But now the thought of being alone in Emmeline's house as night came on was inimical to her. She wanted to talk, even to be allowed to cry, if that's what she found herself doing. And she knew where she had to go. Relieved as she now felt that she had not sent her letter of renunciation to Julietta, she nevertheless told herself that she was not seeking out her lover to be embraced again by her. She was seeking out Julietta and Ashton, her friends and Emmeline's, and with them she would find the comfort she needed. As she approached the tall house in Tedworth Square, she caught a brief glimpse of a well-dressed young woman who ran quickly down the steps and climbed into a waiting carriage. Jane paused in the street, watching the carriage being driven away, and she felt, in that instant, that she knew what had just happened. Julietta was alone in the house and had been visited by one of her beauties. If Jane believed for a moment or two that she should turn round and go straight back to Tite Street, She also knew that she was unable to do this. The thought of Julietta in her bed, damp and somnolent, after the passionate attentions of the young woman, woke in her such mixed feelings of jealousy and longing that all else disappeared from her mind except the need to see the lover she had almost sworn never to meet again. She went up the steps of the house and rang the bell. The maid who answered the door, bobbing a little curtsy to Jane as she went in, was no older than 17 and extremely pretty. And Jane glancingly wondered whether this innocent girl was now and then invited into her mistress's bed. She was led into a large drawing room where a fire was burning. Told that Mr. Sims was abroad and that Mrs. Sims had retired early, she asked the girl to fetch a pen and paper. The maid went out to find this, and Jane sat down on a Louis XVI chair, upholstered in pale blue brocade. She looked around her at the treasures acquired by Ashton Sims and his wife, the Oromolu clock on the marble mantelpiece, the china blackmore holding aloft a gas lamp, the exquisitely covered sofas and chairs, the Georgian tables, the Turkey carpet, the Dutch paintings, the palms in huge ceramic pots, the silver candelabra, the oak bookcase filled with leather-bound editions of Ashton's author's works, the dog basket lined with sheepskin. And she thought, all this is right for Julietta. She belongs to this world of expensive, perfectly arranged things, for she is beauty itself. She could imagine the palms longing to caress her with their leaves, the Dutch pitcher bearer in one of the paintings gazing mournfully down upon her, wishing she could escape from the pitcher to hold Julietta against her bosom. If these thoughts were childlike and foolish, Jane didn't care. She felt herself to be seated now in some inner sanctum of human pulchritude. She could almost hear music rising from the floor or whispering from the walls. When the pretty maid returned with the paper and pen, Jane wrote, "Julietta, my dearest, I am downstairs, seated among your treasures. Please may I come to you. Emmeline is gravely ill and we may be about to lose her. I think that only you can comfort me. Jane." She handed the paper to the girl, knowing perhaps that if the girl could read, she would look at the note, but not minding whether she did or not, even faintly aroused by the notion that this very young woman had knowledge of all that went on in Julietta's room when Ashton was away. Now she was being shown into that room. Julietta lay in an enormous bed, her hair uncoiled on the pillow, her arms bare above the sumptuous satin and brocade coverings. Even before the maid had retreated from the room, Julietta sat up, revealing naked breasts, and called out Jane's name. Jane rushed to her and took her in her arms, smelling at once the musk of the sexual banquet she had indulged in with her beauty, and made bold enough by this to find Julietta's mouth and kiss her so deeply as to make Julietta begin to moan with pleasure. And Jane thought that this kiss was like no other that she'd ever had in her life. And whatever ecstasies Julietta had indulged in only half an hour before, Signora Sims, never sated, now pressed Jane's hand down between her legs to show how ready she was to begin again on one of those wild hours where both women surrendered all restraint and lost themselves in an orgy of loving. In moments, Jane was naked in the bed, her clothes thrown down carelessly on the floor. At the bedside, Julietta's pet spaniel gazed up in sweet perplexity as Jane once again felt the melting touch of la langue de Juliette, known far and wide as the greatest bringer of pleasure a woman could ever know. And this time, because Jane had been deprived of it for so long and was so deeply frustrated by her lovemaking with Ross, the moment of ecstasy was so long and deep it made Jane cry out. Later, Jane put on her clothes, and Julietta put on a satin gown and brushed her hair, and the two women went down to the drawing room, with the little spaniel dog following them. It was now that Jane explained what had happened to her aunt, and Julietta comforted her with the very words Jane ardently wished to hear.
"You will save Emmeline," she said. "Now that you are in London, she will be saved. It is simple as that."
Then, to console them both, Julietta rang for the maid to bank up the waning fire and asked her to bring a jug of claret. When she'd done this and left, and the logs were catching brightly again, Jane whispered to Julietta, "I believe she comes to your bed." "Does she?" And Julietta answered without embarrassment, "I go to her little room, sometimes in the night when Ashton is asleep."
"And you give her la langue?"
"No, servants are too unwashed. We masturbate each other and I leave. It's very innocent. We barely speak, only the unspoken whisperings of women and their needs. But I believe she loves me. Her name is Ellen."
"The world loves you, Julietta. You are the most irresistible being I have ever known."
"And I," said Julietta, taking Jane's hand in hers, "I do believe I love you more than all the others. If it were not for Marco, I can imagine that I could leave Ashton to live with you as man and wife, and we could be wild and wicked every night."
Jane turned away and stared into the fire. The phrase man and wife captured in that instant for her a vision of how happy a life with Julietta would make her, and reaffirmed that the future she had chosen with Valentine Ross was a mistaken one. She knew now that she loved women, Julietta above all, but perhaps other women too, if she knew how to ask for that love. She felt that never in her life had she been more certain of anything. Tall Jane, the angel of the baths, was a lover of women, and she would always be that. To submit to marriage with Ross would be to plunge them both into a lifetime of misery.
At this moment, Ellen came in with the claret and placed the jug and the glasses at Julietta's elbow.
Julietta reached out and touched the maid's shoulder and said,
"Ellen, I've been telling Miss Adine what you and I do sometimes in the night, and she thinks it's very touching and sweet."
A bright blush spread across the girl's features. She opened her mouth to speak, but could find no words.
This seemed to amuse Julietta, and she went on,
"Miss Adine understands that this is very normal and innocent behavior among uninhibited women, and nothing to be ashamed of. Men take advantage of their pretty servants all the time and may often hurt them or get them with child, but we do not hurt each other, do we, Ellen?"
"No, ma'am," said Ellen, "not at all."
"And I've never forced you into anything you don't wish to do?"
"No, Mrs. Sims, for I do wish to do it."
"There you are, then. All is well. You may go now."
Ellen bobbed another curtsy and went out. Jane saw that the blush had spread around that little bit of her neck just visible beneath her white cap, and she found this captivating. The honesty and daring openness with which Julietta lived her life made her gasp. Wherever she went, she found and took whatever she needed and refused to feel abashed by any of it. In Jane's own life, she knew, was not lived like this. It had been a constrained and dedicated life, the life of a virgin spinster, and only too late had she discovered an erotic world with all its possibilities and joys. She felt at that moment that she wanted to howl. She came and knelt in front of the fire and took a sip of the claret and said, "I thought I could marry Dr. Ross, Julietta. I agreed to be his wife in good faith, and I have tried very hard to love him, but I think I cannot go through with it." She turned and saw Julietta staring at her with an expression of alarm and was disconcerted that this should be the case. She had expected Julietta to understand her predicament immediately and to sympathize with her decision to abandon her marriage to Ross. After a long moment, Julietta said,
"I hear what you're saying, Jane dearest, but what are you going to do about the other great matter then?"
"You mean about you?"
"No, I will always be here for you. I mean about your state."
"What state?"
"Oh, you didn't know, Jane. You didn't know that you're pregnant."
Jane gaped at Julietta. Like the maid moments before, she could find no words.
"I suppose you hadn't realized, my poor darling," Julietta went on. "But I know. When I give la langue to pregnant woman, the perfume of her cunt is different. I am never wrong."
Chapter 41, What Tamina Knew. It was at about this time that the White Rajah fell into a depression. He tried to fight it off, but didn't seem to have the right weapons. Drinking arak lifted his spirits for a while, but then the darkness closed in on him again. Walking in his garden, seeing the bright parakeets in their aviary, and the scarlet lilies all aflame in the sunshine, could make him glad that he had ownership of these beautiful things, that his eye alone had seen how they might bring him solace. But then he would remember the hammocks, side by side, where he had lain with Edmund Ross and listened to his New Testament readings, and he would feel his mind sliding down once more into an abyss of sadness. After he'd been shown Edmund's body, already decomposing in the forest floor, he had made himself help the Dyaks with the terrible task of digging it up and transporting it on a cart to the grounds of his house. Here, not far from where the hammocks had once been strung, it was reburied, and Sir Ralph reluctantly summoned one of the Catholic missionaries from Kuching to intone a mass over the dead man's grave. Some of the Malay servants had attended this mass, crossing themselves from time to time and showing careful respect for the foolish England man who had perished in the forest. But Leon had stayed away. Later he asked the Raja why he wept for the Jesus boy and accused him of taking Edmund secretly as his lover. And when he said this, Sir Ralph did a thing that he would never normally think of doing. He slapped Leon's face. For a moment, it looked to Sir Ralph as though Leon was about to begin one of those physical fights they sometimes indulged in, both of them growling with anger and mortification and conflicted desire. But Leon only nursed his cheek, looked at him with disdain, then turned and ran away. He ran out of the house and was not seen again for 3 days. Work had begun on the new portion of the Savage Road that would lead to the river and the site of the cannery, and the Raja was interested to see the jungle being cleared, foundations laid, and stones broken to form the hard core of the new highway. The Chinese labor brought in by Leon for these arduous tasks toiled in the great heat. With their small, slim bodies and their wide, conical straw hats, they appeared to Sir Ralph to resemble little mushrooms, bobbing about, scrabbling for a place in the earth. He knew that this was an amusing way to think about them, which normally would have made him smile, but he discovered that it saddened him. The life of a mushroom, so brief, he now compared to his own existence in Borneo. He had popped up here as though overnight, in his white clothes with his burning red-brown skin beneath, and people had gathered round to stare at him. He had gained a footing in nature's realm. Now he was decaying. His heart was pulp. He would soon be gone. He dated his decline into depression from two events: the disappearance of Edmund and Leon's obsession with the cannery. He blamed his own inattention in both cases. Why had he not noticed straight away when Edmund had gone missing from their trek to the river? Now Edmund was dead, and he would, in due time, be obliged to search for the address of his brother in England and write to him, relating the sad news. But he put off doing this. He dreaded to be held to account for his failure to take care of Edmund. And as for the cannery, why had he not refused to sanction the wretched fish factory? It was his money that was going to pay for it, not Leon's. And already great damage had been done. In the shaking hands of Septimus Scaife, so much gunpowder had been packed into his paper tubes and lodged at the feet of the mangroves that the resulting mighty explosion he had boasted about had not only blasted the trees out of the water, it had killed all the fish in a mile-long stretch of the Sodong. Their bodies floated to the surface, nudged along the current by the broken tree trunks. Hundreds of turtles also died, and their severed limbs littered the riverbanks, vitiating the air and bringing vultures down from Mount Ophir. When Leon was shown this sight, he stuck out his tongue and screamed at Scaife, threatening to scatter his limbs along the Sodong and accusing him of sabotaging the project deliberately. The Raja witnessed the engineer turn white, and in his attempts to move backwards away from Leon, fall over his own feet and land ignominiously on his bottom in the mud. He began to protest that the fish would return, that eggs laid upriver by the turtles would hatch, but Leon could only see a white man's ignorance, stupidity, and malign intent. Without consulting Sir Ralph, he dismissed Septimus Scaife on the spot, telling him to leave Borneo within 1 day and never return. He told the terrified man that if he had a dagger in his belt, he would have plunged it into his heart. The Raja was tempted to help Scaife to his feet. He looked so forlorn and foolish sitting there amongst the river debris, but he didn't dare to side with him against Leon. Furthermore, he was inclined to believe that Scaife, humiliated by being sent away from the Raja's house into a lowly cottage, had intended him some harm. Indeed, he had always suspected it. After the 3 days of Leon's absence, Saraf went in search of him. He couldn't wait passively any longer, because over his sadness was now laid an intolerable frustration, Leon's absence from his bed. For all Leon's bluster, the Raja knew that he sometimes crept away from this side of himself to spend time with his mother, Tamina. In the presence of his mother, Leon became more docile and quiet. He would often show Tamina tender affection. Sometimes he swept her house and cooked a meal for her in one of her blackened pots. Sometimes he helped her to wash her hair in the river. It was to Tamina's house, therefore, that Sir Ralph made his way. He found Tamina sitting on her hard chair on her veranda. She was cleaning sweet potatoes in a bucket. Beneath the black beech stilts of her house, her pet cockerel stepped daintily around, searching for seeds and grains of millet. Tamina stood up, and the Raja bowed politely to her. He had bought her the gift of some pomegranates, and she took them in her thin hands and smiled at Sir Ralph, then disappeared into the darkness of her house. He hoped that she'd gone to fetch Leon, but she only reemerged with another wooden chair, which she placed beside her own in the shade, and a small cup of arak, which the Raja took from her gratefully. Though he wanted to ask her straight away if she knew where Leon was, he preferred her to think that he had called on her only out of courtesy. In his fractured Malay, he began asking her if she'd been troubled by the explosion upriver. She had heard it, she told him, and she had found dead Subaru in the pool below her house. She had netted these and cooked them, but thrown them away because they had not tasted right.
"My son," she said, "he believes he will get rich from a cannery. But we who live along the Sadong don't wish for such machinery to disturb the morning. We do not trust England engineers."
"Perhaps you are right," said Sir Ralph. "The one who came here was inept. But Leon may have gone in search of other people to undertake this. Has he?"
"I have not seen him since the last rain."
"Ah.
But when I see him, Raja, I shall tell him this. There is a plateau now where the mangroves are gone. What he must do is build there, but not a house for fish cans."
"Houses for families?"
"No, Raja. Sir, houses for the sick and dying. The hospital."
Tamina was scratching now at the strangely pigmented skin of her face. It was a sorrowful habit of hers which Sir Ralph had often witnessed, and her cheeks were scarred with welts, where her nails had brought out pinpricks of blood. Sir Ralph took a long sip of arak. Then he asked,
"Do we need a hospital here in the forest?"
"We will need it, Raja. I was in Kuching. I went there in my neighbor Rashid's mule cart to buy tallow candles and paraffin for my lamp. And as we drove along the streets, Rashid said to me, 'Tamina, can you smell it? And do you see how a vapor hangs in the air?' I looked at it and I saw it, and then I breathed in deeply and I could smell it. The mal de peste."
"Dengue fever?"
"I think it is already in Kuching. They say that government soldiers are going to bring in cannon to fire to try and purify the air. But if it is already there, then it will travel to us and people will begin dying. And some will look to you to help them, Raja. For why are you called Raja if you cannot help the people on your lands?"
Sir Ralph laid aside the arak and looked out at the vibrant yellows and greens of Tamina's banana grove and the bamboos clustering down towards the river pool. And he thought, as he often did, how much he wanted everything to grow and thrive like these things. But what, in the end, could one man do against the catastrophes decided upon by nature? When Sir Ralph got back to his house, he found Leon lying in his room. Leon looked pale and tired. He said he'd been in Kuching to go with the boys, and he needed to sleep now. The Raja sat down on Leon's bed. If he had not had the conversation with Tamina about the mal de peste, he might have been more wounded about the idea of boys than he was. But what worried him principally now was that his lover had been in Kuching and might already have caught the sickness that was beginning there. He reached for Leon's hand, but Leon moved it away.
"Boys," he said, "very exhausting. Want fuck all the time."
The Raja stared at Leon. His smooth brow, his flattish nose, his sensual lips, his long black eyelashes, and thought, "Whatever he says to me, however he taunts me, I will never not be awed by how beautiful I find him."
"I will leave you to sleep, Leon," he said gently. "But I have been talking with your mother. She tells me we must stop building a hospital."
"I know," said Leon. "I know all about it.
Bad fever. Those boys tell me while I'm fucking them. I make a joke. I say, is that why we are fucking then, to keep death from the door?"
Saraf ignored this and said,
"Tamina suggests we build longhouses and make bamboo bunks for the sick, where the cannery was going to be sited, on that new plateau."
"I know," said Leon again. "No fish factory now. No money for Leon. No money for you, Raja. My beautiful idea kaput."
Chapter 42. Out of Reach. Jane left Juliet's bed at dawn and walked back to Tite Street. She asked for hot water and washed herself. She felt dizzy from lack of sleep, but was now concerned only with getting back to the hospital to rescue Emmeline. She knew that the day in front of her would be long and difficult, but her hours with Juliet had been so extraordinary, they'd given her both peace and strength. As she washed herself, she looked at her body in the mirror. It appeared to her the same as it always appeared. If she was indeed pregnant, it would still be so early in the process that she told herself she wouldn't even think about it. Not yet. Carrying Julieta in her heart and in her blood, she would now begin her fight to get Emmeline back. She had brought to London the gown she wore as the Angel of the Baths, and she would now put this on. All the skill she possessed would be directed at making Emmeline well and placing her gently back in the life she loved. She ordered Nancy to go out and buy fresh loaves, milk, and oysters, and asked the chemist for a strong fruit cordial and a balsam of camphor. She supervised the laying of clean starched sheets on Emmeline's bed and searched her studio for books she might read aloud to her, pressing to her breast the poems of Tennyson, Browning, and Christina Rossetti. She prepared a warming pan. She mixed tooth powder in a small dish. Then she went out into the neglected garden and searched the tangled area for flowers. She found a few pansies clustering under brambles and picked these and arranged them in a little cut glass vase, which she placed on Emmeline's dressing table. She took one of Emmeline's turbans from a hat box and put it into a canvas hold-all. Then she set forth in a hansom cab for the hospital. On the short journey, she found herself summoning thoughts of her own mother, never known by Jane, her life ending only minutes after her daughter's began. Her name was Alice. By Sir William's account, Alice had been a person to whom human kindness came as easily as breathing. And it was often said of her that she'd never done any wrong in the world. And Jane thought now, I have done wrong in the eyes of English society, which forbids love between women. And I will do wrong again. And she wondered with sudden sadness whether this kindly mother, this perfect Alice, would have cast her daughter out from her affection because of her sexual transgressions. Was it better, she wondered then, that Emmeline had had to play the motherly role? She who had given birth to nothing but half-formed creatures ejected from her body in agony and memorialized in a clay golem, but who seemed to understand so well what was in Jane's nature and in her heart. Had Alice died knowing that her daughter would come to need a different mother? If these thoughts had something strangely hard-hearted about them, Jane also knew that she had never needed Emmeline more than she needed her now. It was only to her aunt that she could reveal the dilemma that she was in, certain to receive Emmeline's calm wisdom on how her future might unfold. Jane held herself very tall as she went in through the high doors at the hospital entrance. The long corridor which led to the room where Emmeline lay was deserted, except for a thin woman kneeling on a slatted wooden board, scrubbing the stone floor with carbolic soap and a pail of grey water. As Jane walked by, she removed her coat, letting the woman see her white nurse's gown beneath, and the kneeling woman stared up at her in perplexity, as if she'd seen someone or something unearthly. Jane strode on. Feeling choked by the strong smell of carbolic, she realized that her heart was beating very fast. She entered the vaulted space she termed the anteroom of death. As before, it was empty of nursing staff and very dark, with all but one of the window shutters closed. She saw that a large wooden table had been placed between the two rows of beds, and on this were laid out small bowls of junket, with in each one a stubby wooden spoon, such as one might give to a child to feed itself. Junket was a food Jane found repellent, but at least it was sustenance of a kind, indicating the dying women were fed from time to time. She snatched up one of the bowls and made her way to Emmeline's bed. She was about to sit down beside her aunt and tried to persuade her to eat some junket before she prepared her for the journey back to Tite Street, when she looked down and saw that the person in the bed was not Emmeline. She was a small woman with a shriveled forehead and tiny hands like the claws of a little jungle animal. Jane looked all around her, then walked slowly down the ward, examining the occupants of the iron cots. Pale, startled faces, many scalps shorn of hair, bony fingers clutching at sheets or holding on to the iron bedheads as if to anchor themselves to what remained on their time on earth. When they saw Jane, one or two of the women called out to her, reminding her of the way the sick called to her at the baths. These people did not call her Angel. They did not know who this tall stranger could be, but only that she looked strong and that she was there and not hiding from them, as the other nurses so often chose to do. The crying out of the patients did at last bring forth a portly matron, too fat for her uniform, cramming the last morsel of a jam tart into her cheeks. A few sticky crumbs came tumbling from her mouth as she shouted at Jane, "What in the world are you doing here? Did you come to steal the patient's junket?" Jane held herself very still. She allowed the matron to come bustling very close to her before she replied calmly, "I came looking for my aunt, Miss O'Dean, to take her home."
"Who is Miss O'Dean?" said the matron.
"Miss Emmeline O'Dean, the artist. I came to see her yesterday evening. I informed two of the doctors that I would be returning this morning to convey her home."
"Well," said the matron, "I know of no such person, and I've been here since 6 o'clock doing the roster, and no one of that name is on this ward."
Jane pointed to the cot where Emmeline had lain. She was about to say that this had been Emmeline's bed, when the matron surprised her by snatching the bowl of junket out of her hand and slamming it down onto the table, after which she turned tail and began to walk away. "Where is my aunt?" Jane cried out. The matron was almost at the door when she said,
"If a female patient who was here yesterday is not here today, then there is only one place she will be, in the morgue."
She was gone then, and Jane stood very still, trying to catch her breath. She put a hand to her throat as if to ease the passage of air. She was aware of some of the dying women attempting to sit up, to see her more clearly, this stranger in a white gown who had been stricken by the words of the matron. One of them reached out a beckoning hand to her, and Jane, wondering if this woman knew what happened to Emmeline, moved towards her. But as she did so, the patient made a frenzied gesture towards the bowls of junket on the table, then pointed to her mouth. Jane turned to fetch the food for her, and as she did so, other women began calling out for the junket, and Jane wondered if they were often tortured like this, food being placed near them but not within their reach. She began distributing the bowls, placing them gently into trembling hands. All of this she did with her thoughts peculiarly absent from her actions. It was as if these things were being done in order simply to keep her breathing until she found the will to undergo the next moments of her life. The hospital morgue was housed in a deep cellar. Jane was led down to it by one of the doctors she'd seen the evening before. He gave her a steadying arm, His former impatience with her appeared to have been mastered. Jane thought about the last time she'd been in a morgue, in Paris. All that had been asked of her then was pity. Now she'd been plunged into her own sorrow. The doctor told her that Emmeline had died in her sleep, not long after she left. In cases like hers, he said, where the damage to the heart is great, we always pray that death comes quickly.